So first, say good morning, everybody. Ajahn Kevali has asked me to say some encouraging words. Some of you know Ajahn Acharlo, some of you don't know me yet. I ordained 1 year before Ajahn Kevali. We're good friends. I live in a monastery in Phetchabun, about a 9 hours drive away in the mountains. I've been living there for 7 years now. Recently got back from a period of intensive meditation practice in Bodh Gaya, and this is an interesting time to be asked to give a reflection. I don't begin all of my talks with the statement that I have to be careful not to sound too impressive, but in this occasion I have to be careful not to sound too impressive. So I'll sound slightly impressive first, and then I'll explain later. So I made a vow. I went to Bodh Gaya as a six-panta monk 16 years ago, and I felt I'm a faith type, I would say. It's a little bit unusual among Western monks, but very common for Thai monks. And so I found I was very deeply moved by the place, and I did have a very peaceful meditation there. And for me, it was as though you could feel, smell, taste, touch Nibbana. It's so close. And how this affected my mind at the time was this desire to want to sit longer and sit longer. Hoping, of course, to realize Nibbana, that didn't happen. But at least feeling closer to it is encouraging, isn't it? So after my 10th panta, I had been living with Ajahn Anand for quite some time, and I asked his permission to go and spend 6 weeks and try and explore this further. And I went back again. I think it was the beginning of building my monastery. Just before receiving the invitation to build a monastery, I realized that I was going to need some help, not just on the material level, but building the monastery from scratch on top of a mountain. There was no water system, electrical system, and the road was impassable in the wet season. So I knew I was going to need help, and so I wanted to go and ask for the help of the devas. Ajahn Acharlo is someone who believes in devas, beings in parallel realms who have goodwill towards human beings. Some of them have a lot of merit and sympathy towards Buddhist practitioners, so go and ask for their help. So around that time, I realized that I was approaching 1,000 hours of meditation under the Bodhi tree. And I thought that that would be a good thing to work towards. So I came back a couple of years later, and I did finish off 1,000 hours of formal meditation as an offering to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha under the Bodhi tree. Then in a moment of, I mean, that felt really good to be able to do that. And but Bodh Gaya is a place which is very noisy. There's a lot of people. So basically meditating in public all day and large crowds moving around behind you. So it's hard work, but because there is some special quality in the air there, we'll talk a bit more about that later, what that might be. Many people find that it is possible for the mind to become peaceful despite the noise, despite the crowds, if one has faith and if one keeps trying. But I felt so pleased to have accomplished that 1,000 hours that in a rapturous, blissful moment, I made what might have been a foolish aspiration to sit 2,000 more hours there. 1,000 for the Buddha, 1,000 for the Dhamma, 1,000 for the Sangha. And so I did keep going back once a year, and usually would do, I had to work up to this, so at first I could only sit about 6.5 hours in a day in Bodh Gaya, and I worked up to about 8 hours, and getting from 8.5 to 9 hours a day was, I don't know why, but it was just really hard to get past the inner resistance to just, I think we all know we want to spend some periods of time in quiet and alone, so there's a certain point when you're in a noisy, busy place where you've had enough. And knee pain, and back pain, those things. So to get past the 8.5 point was a bit of a struggle, but I did. I was able to work up to sitting 10 hours a day in Bodh Gaya. And I think the reason this was possible is because of the strong faith that I have in Buddhas and the gratitude that I have for Lord Buddha. And then we think of the particular vow Lord Buddha made there when he sat down and he said, let my blood dry up, let my sinews fall off, something like that. I'm not moving from this place until I've realized the deathless. And he did. So it's an incredible affirmation about the potential that we have, that Lord Buddha fulfilled and realized. So you get a bit fed up in Bodh Gaya and you open your eyes and you see the Bodhi tree and you look at the Vajrasana and you can remind yourself, Lord Buddha was enlightened here. So it's quite a powerful, skillful means, and it offers a lot of encouragement. And so I was able to work up to that. Once working up to 10 hours a day, I would try to do that for at least a month. So I earlier trips, I was doing 200 hours in a month. Later trips, I was trying to do 300 hours in 33 days. Most recently, I've been doing 400 hours in 45 days. I've done that three times. And so I did, just 5 days ago, complete that vow. I have now sat in meditation for 3,000 hours under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya. And I'm relieved. I don't have to keep doing that to myself anymore. But it's not really about, it was never about getting to a certain number. It was about using that place as a source of inspiration that inspired more practice. So basically what we're all involved in is cultivating the five spiritual powers: faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. So Lord Buddha, after his enlightenment, when he was reviewing what it was that actually made it possible for him to realize what he realized, he was able to come up with this quite beautiful, small, succinct list. These five qualities, when cultivated, made much of, lead to the deathless, emerge in the deathless. So Ajahn Sumedho, when he was a young monk, he used to use this as a bit of a mantra: Satta, Virya, Sati, Samadhi, Panya. He had the intuition, the correct intuition, that all of these qualities need to be strong and they need to be balanced. And so he was checking in his practice which ones are strong and which ones are weak. I think this is very valuable. So with regards faith, sometimes we have faith in the Buddha, we have faith in the Arahants. Many modern people don't have faith in their ultimate potential. Many people have a withholding of loving kindness towards themselves, a kind of a deep-seated self-aversion, which manifests as a kind of a sneering at oneself internally, judging everything you do. Whatever you do is not quite good enough. And we understand about the Buddhas are enlightened, we understand that Arahants are enlightened, and we understand the teaching, and we understand what we're supposed to do to get it, and we read Lumpur Mun's biography, Lumpur Tate's biography, and we want to do that. And then I think many people start judging themselves and compared to this example. And modern people aren't very patient. So what starts as very virtuous, having faith, finding the teachings, doing the correct practices, can get infected by negative qualities. And because it's culturally so pervasive, I think many people don't recognize it. And this kind of judging your own efforts and kind of sneering at yourself, having ill will aimed at the self-view, is something that saps away energy and decreases your chances of realizing the mind's potential. So a practice that I personally feel all modern people need to do to kind of remove this curse from their minds is they need to commit to metta practice. And metta practice starts with one's own conventional self. Well, something I found in practicing in Bodh Gaya is not to become irritated. You have to practice a lot of metta because metta has many benefits. One of the benefits of metta is it allows you to accept things the way they are. When you have a lot of goodwill, when you wish well, it's not a critical rejecting discriminating kind of a quality. It's a loving, accepting, embracing quality, a soft quality. So I had to practice probably, I'd say, at least 30% of the time in Bodhgaya, loving kindness, so that's about at least 3 hours a day of metta meditation. And that's what makes it possible not to be irritated when the Cambodian group comes around with a very, very loud speaker and with reverb and echo and chanting very, very loudly right behind you. And then the Vietnamese group does the same thing 5 meters away, and the Sri Lankan group 15 meters away. And sometimes Bodhi leaves fall on you there, but sometimes birds come and shit on you also. And so in order to be able to work with this interesting range, variety of phenomena, the various things that fall on one and around one, metta is very helpful. I have a lot of experience of that. What makes it possible to be able to sit under the Bodhi tree for 10 hours a day? When it's hot, when it's cold, when you're sick, faith in the Buddha and metta, a capacity to be with things as they are. This is very, very important. So I always like to encourage the Wat Nanachak community to please give good energy to your metta bhavana. And may all beings be well, may all beings be happy is where we'd like to be able to take it. But that loving kindness towards all beings, it has to be radiated from the center of this conventional being. So if you can't yet hold really profound, beautiful, deeply nourishing loving kindness in the core of this being, there's no way you're going to be able to radiate it profoundly to other beings. So this is something that has to be done. This is something that has to be accomplished. And so you shouldn't think it's selfish or self-indulgent or vain to wish yourself well and try to fill your own heart with loving kindness to the utmost of your ability. This is a unnegotiable, fundamentally important, something that you have to be able to do. It only becomes self-indulgent if you don't move on from there. If you do move on from there, as the traditional training encourages, to include more beings that you find it easy to have loving kindness towards, and then larger numbers of beings that you feel neutral towards, and then finally beings that you have aversion towards, then it might be vain and selfish if you don't cultivate it further. But in terms of the initial stages, you have to. You have to be able to hold a genuine quality of unconditional love, loving acceptance, goodwill, which isn't judging and rejecting and pushing away, kind of shooting yourself in the foot. So please try to feel confident in the value of that. And if you feel a lot of resistance to it, well then you have to have metta for that. So compassion works with the metta. And I find a good way to get a compassionate response going is just to ask yourself, if you're feeling a lot of resistance to metta practice, that's a kind of a suffering. And so you put your awareness in your heart area. Ask yourself, is there suffering? Is this suffering? And if you can feel that it is suffering, that there is suffering, then you ask yourself, can I respond to this with kindness? And so with compassion, in terms of meditation, you don't have to do anything in terms of physically or with your speech. But in terms of responding with your heart, it's just with that wish. May I be free from suffering? And so you become aware of the suffering, and then you just soften, and you just make the kind wish. May this be able to be resolved. May I be able to go beyond this. May I be free from suffering. And if you can get some compassion for the conventional being that suffers, I mean, that's why we're here. I don't think you'd be coming and maintaining precepts regarding to celibacy and all the things that you have to give up if you didn't have some suffering. And if you didn't believe that there was a way to go beyond suffering, that's what brings us here. And so having kindness, not judgmentalness towards your own suffering, is something that will be very nurturing. And it's very important because I'm 21 punsas and I've seen many, many monks disrobe. I'm just noticing about half of the community here are very new people coming to the training, and so many people around 10 punsas, 12 punsas, 14 punsas, very good monks. And they get a bit fed up because they wanted more results than the results that they got. And there's something in them that's judging this lack of result. And they decide to leave the training And I've met many of these people after they've disrobed, and you ask them, okay, so do you feel that you developed further since disrobing? I've never met a single person who said they had. Do you feel good about disrobing? I think I met one. Of all the people that disrobed, one person felt that they were in a better state. Most people feel that things degenerated. So we have to be careful. If you're really interested in doing this for a lifetime, I could never commit to it. When I first came to the training, I could only get through one punsa and then commit to another punsa. When I got to 5 punsas, I committed to 10 punsas. When I got to 10 punsas, I committed to 20. Now I'm intending to be a bhikkhu until I die. But one has to work up to that kind of resolute determination and stretch one's capacity. But if you do really have faith in this training, there's really not much point in going backwards. And so one of the qualities that help people to stay is whether or not you've cultivated these Brahmaviharas. The Brahmaviharas the Buddha describes as a pleasant abiding here and now. So it's like if you genuinely have metta for yourself, meditating isn't a painful experience. You can just be kind to yourself. And contentment isn't difficult to attain. But if there's something inside you that's saying it's not good enough yet, should be better than this, why aren't you? Why don't you have the jhanas? Why don't you have the jnanas? You should be a sotapanna by now. Then that's really painful. And Ajahn Chah says, you can water the tree, and then you have to wait for the sun, and you can fertilize it, but with regards to when the fruit comes, we don't have control over that. And this is actually conceit, and this is ditti and mana. This is self-view that thinks it knows when the fruit should come. And that's not what you should be listening to. That's delusion. And trust the Kribrajans, trust the path, and trust that it will ripen in its own time. But with regards, really, I mean, I've seen many, many monks do this, so somehow I'm at 21 punsas and intending to continue. So one of the things I look at that I cultivated that many of my friends didn't is I have been more diligent with the Brahmaviharas practice. And so I do think it's very helpful. But talking about faith in the Buddha, in the path, in the Kribrajans, in the teachings, then in your ability, it's very important. It's not possible that the nature of one being is different to the nature of another being. So the fact that the Buddha could become a Buddha, he didn't start as a special being. He started as an ordinary being with greed, hatred and delusion. At one point, he probably had more greed, hatred and delusion than we all have right now, at some point in his karmic history. But he kept training himself, and he didn't give up. And in terms of having a willingness to be patient with the process, you think about the Buddha spending 4 asankhya and 100,000 eons to build the qualities and the virtue to be a Buddha. An eon is like the time since the Big Bang and the universe expanding and then the universe contracting and burning up again. That's 1 eon. So 100,000 eons, that's the small part at the end after the 4 asankhya, the incalculable. Only a Buddha can measure that sheer amount of time. So I think it's good to challenge our impatience sometimes, and it's good to challenge our expectation of quick results. If you really surrender to this training and to this process, it doesn't matter when the results come. That's the present moment Dhamma. It is how it is now, and you keep practicing, and at some point there's going to be a moment where things change significantly. And until then, you do have small insights, which become bigger insights, which become deeper insights, which become universe-exploding, liberating insights. So checking in your practice, faith gives rise to energy, one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it. So check your levels of faith. Sometimes we want to have faith in a place, and that's only one of the things you need to have faith in. No single place is going to be perfect. No single place is going to inspire you a lot. It will for a little while. When you come from your worldly life and you come to Wat Nanachan, it's very inspiring. And you stay here for 6 months, it's less inspiring. And then you have to maintain a perspective. One of the other good things about going to India is seeing a lot of very poorly behaved monks, and not trained monks, fake monks even, robbers in robes, selling Bodhi leaves under the Bodhi tree. And you come back to a place like Nanachat, and it's like, whoa. I know a lot of some people might be feeling now that it's not so inspiring, but take it from me, it's very inspiring. You have to have enough faith in the place where you're training. You don't have to have great faith. What you need to have great faith in is the Buddha. And you need to have great faith in the Krubrajans. You need to have enough faith that the place where you're practicing is good enough. And then you need to have faith in your ability. And the other thing I want to suggest that you need to have faith in is effort. And no one else can do this for you. This is something we have to give attention to. So, four great efforts, part of the Bodhipakhyatamas. We have to put forth the effort. This is a karmic path. The Eightfold Path is a set of karmic conditions that lead to a state beyond karma. But we have to use the conditions. We have to cultivate certain qualities, generate certain types of merit, and then realizing the unconditioned is the result, but we have to work with these conditions and we have to put really a lot of effort into it. Motivated from compassion and motivated with faith, this is very different from being motivated by willpower. If you can get some good energy from a correct quality of faith, drop away some of the things that sap energy, then you'll find that when you put forth an effort, good energy arises. And this is what we then have to invest into our consistent mindfulness. And if you're mindful consistently throughout the day and you meditate morning, afternoon, evening, every day, then there will be a development of more samadhi and there will be seeing things more clearly according to their characteristics. That's what wisdom is. Wisdom is seeing things according to their real characteristics, not according to delusion or misinterpretation. In terms of wanting profound results this lifetime, I think it's wholesome, but it has to be held in a certain way. It can't be held with expecting them. But it's good to be determined to sow the causes, but without the time frame, and that's the tricky part. So, 21 punces, middle-aged, grey-haired man now. I'm not reducing my efforts. I don't want to be one of these monks that gets to 20, 30 punces and looks back when I was a young monk and thinks that I was really inspired and I practiced hard as a young monk. I want to be the kind of monk that gets more senior and thinks, because actually I wasn't very impressive as a young monk. I complained a lot, cried quite a bit at my kuti, and bitched and moaned about various things. So I wasn't impressive as a young bhikkhu, but I did have a strong quality of faith. And I did have courage and determination. And as well as a lot of complaining. But what I have faith in is slowly increasing your efforts over time and not giving up. And if you do that, then you become capable of doing more than you thought you could do. And you do get some good results as a result of your practice. I thought I would read something because I kept a bit of a journal when I was in India, and I'm just going to read a few paragraphs because I think it captures some of what we were practicing with. So I wrote this when I'd reached this was day 42 out of 45 days of intensive retreat, and it was the day that I reached 99% of my goal, 2,970 hours of 3,000. This was the day when I really allowed myself to feel truly confident that I was actually going to make it to the total of 3,000 hours. I have never allowed myself to feel this since making the vow after completing 1,000 hours that I would complete 2,000 more here. I was committed and determined, but not complacent, because I knew it could simply not be taken for granted. There was a lot of hard work before me and infinite potential for obstructions. The bomb scare the month before we arrived could have led to greater restrictions, where sitting all day may not have been possible. Or a bomb could actually have exploded. The sharp knee pain on the first day in my left knee that I'd never had before could have gotten worse. The food poisoning, the chest infection, might have been minor illnesses compared to a more serious one that followed. And then there is the slow build-up of fatigue and exhaustion. There could have been more and more weddings, late-night weddings with loud music keeping us from sleep. The physical and mental energy just might not be there to carry me through. And tripping up the staircase and falling over might have been truly debilitating, rather than just leaving an apple-sized bruise in beautiful shades of purple, red, and blue. And yet, day 42 of 45 has come and gone. Having gotten to the 99% point of my goal today, then anticipating commencing the first of the final 3 days tomorrow, that will comprise the last 1%, was a true watershed moment. An enormous pressure fell away from my heart, and there were quiet tears of joy and relief. By mid-afternoon, I could feel that the end of the meditation marathon was truly very close. In a way, I think that today has been the day where I actually felt the true accomplishment of this task and felt relieved of the enormous burden too. Goodness, those bittersweet yet delicious tears of joy and relief on the cushion this afternoon were hard won. Sheer exhaustion as the weeks progress shrink your world a great deal, and you just have to try and get through the day, one day at a time. Sometimes it feels like you won't make it till the end of the day, and so you simply don't have the energy to think of the future at all. So much so that I had not anticipated this wonderful moment. It really caught me by surprise. It is astonishing to think that just yesterday I'd felt such tremendous resistance in the morning meditation. Now, just 30 or so hours later, it all seems so close. The days have gone by one after another, and finally, it's truly within reach. Of course, this meditation vow has never actually been about reaching a certain number. I have been clear about this from the beginning. Setting this goal was actually about forcing myself to commit even more deeply to a transformative process, one that I am already deeply committed to anyway. It was about stretching spiritual capacities and abilities and increasing the chances of experiencing true insight and deep peace, about taking several steps further along a journey towards final liberation. And doing this in the very place where the Buddhas in this universe reached their final goal, after thousands of eons of cultivation. In working up my abilities to sit longer here over a period of years, then stretching the time periods out for longer, and in not allowing for days off, except for illness during these retreats, I have been deliberately working right at the very limit of my ability, and stretching it further. Because it is possible to do more here, if you have great faith, when recollecting the example and efforts of the Buddha. The five spiritual powers of faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom that Lord Buddha explained as being qualities which lead to enlightenment get developed a great deal in meditation retreats, perhaps especially in this place where there is so much faith and spiritual energy. Meditating in Bodhgaya with all of its noisy, chaotic, crazy charm requires the development of mindfulness and skillful means as well as wisdom. And you couldn't or wouldn't do it without great faith. The faith is then deepened further in the process. But it has not just been struggle. The commitment, consistency, effort and struggle create a container which is very rich in spiritual potential. Although I have not yet attained a higher stage of enlightenment, there has been development. There have been many wonderful moments of deep peace, of seeing the mind let go of things which cause suffering, and then experiencing the mind at peace through having let go. There have been experiences of extremely deep faith and gratitude towards the Buddhas and this path. There have been periods where the loving-kindness meditation became so vast that I could not have imagined it possible to feel such love. Similarly, I've been able to experience profound equanimity towards the most extraordinary impingement that I had never have considered possible a few years ago. There were other special experiences too, but our monastic rules forbid me from describing them further. Suffice to say, though, that these times of practice at the Mahabodhi Temple, as well as being quite difficult, have also been deeply encouraging and rewarding. So I just want to point to, if you had told me 10 years ago that I would meditate 10 hours a day in Bodhgaya for a month and a half, and that I would do that repeatedly, I don't think I would have believed it, actually. And so I just want to suggest to people that if you're willing to have a longer time frame than most people have, what we want to achieve within this month, 1 year, 2 years, 5 years. If you're willing to think about what you might be able to do after a couple of decades and within one lifetime and a few more lifetimes, and then I think you'll probably be able to do much more than you ever imagined. And so I offer that as my reflection this morning.
Sadhu, sadhu.